Okay, so good morning, everyone. We are about to hear the third case on our oral argument calendar today. That case is Kawalit S. Bhatia as trustee for the next of kin of Anna M. Bhatia, deceased appellant, versus Owners Insurance Company respondent, case number 8210378. Just a few comments before we hear from the attorneys this morning. Your argument will be recorded, is being recorded, and an audio version will be available on the court's website shortly. I think you both are familiar with our timing requirements, but as a brief refresh, the appellant will have 15 minutes to argue, respondent will have 15 minutes to argue, and then appellant will be permitted to make a 5-minute rebuttal argument. The time is being kept right on the screen, and that number that you see right now will be counting you down. I would ask that everyone here mute themselves, if not speaking. And then finally, counsel, if you could please identify yourselves before you begin your arguments. Those conclude my remarks. Mr. Rogoszewski, are you ready to go?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
You may proceed.
Your Honor, Paul Rogoszewski, appearing for the appellate. May it please the court. I think it's clear from the record that everyone agrees that the issue here is whether or not the decedent, Ina Bhatia, is a resident relative of her father's household. I think we all agree that the Fireman versus Victoria, quoting the Pamperon case, sets out the three factors that we should take a look at to make that determination. And I think we all agree that this is a fact question. And I think we all agree, and the district court found that factor two is met, and that was that Ina Bhatia and her father were in a close, intimate family relationship. And that's where we think the court erred in finding summary judgment, that she didn't apply this intimate family relationship to the other two factors. The intimate family relationship is boxcarred in divorce, a business, and the culture of the Indian culture. They have a very, very close relationship. They want their children to be involved in the business. And Ina and her brother were involved in the business from whenever they could start. And that was usually at 16. Certainly here, Ina was in the business doing it full time after she graduated from high school. So she was at least in the business for 3.5 years, working for her father. And her father took care of everything. She didn't want for anything. She didn't. She was paid through her father.
Mr. Rogoszewski, it seems the dispositive issue, at least to the district court, was whether Ina was residing with her father. Are you arguing that the district court erred in focusing on that factor in its analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason is because of this intimate family relationship. When you have a divorce, the kids live in a couple different residences. And in this particular case, because of the culture and the nature of the business, she lived not only with her father in Burnsville, as the record shows and the affidavit of the father shows, she had a room in the Burnsville residence. She had a key to the Burnsville residence. She kept her belongings at the Burnsville residence. She could stay there anytime. And she could stay at the family business where she worked all the time. And the family business happened to have 4 apartments upstairs. All of them are the family business. One was for the father, one was for the brother, one was for Ina. The 4th one was just there. There was no rent paid by Ina. The father took care of everything. Nobody else rented those things. You could call them another bedroom. In other words, the father happened to have 2 residents because of the divorce and the culture of the business. So here the court erred in not taking that intimate family relationship and saying, my gosh, in this divorce situation and in this culture, really the father had two residences because he stayed at the Maharaji's as well. And so he had a residence at Burnsville. He had a residence at Maharaji's, and she lived there and was taken care of. She was not self-supporting. Her father took care of everything. Gave her a car. This car that she was that ties her into the insurance. She was a rated driver under that policy, and the insurance company sent the bills and believed that Jit Bhatia was living at Maharaji's. They sent the bills to 205 East 7th Street, which is the address of Maharaji's. Now, even the apartments up above, which were 201 to 207, which are just bedrooms, really, is the mail all is delivered to 205 East 7th Street, which is the business address of Maharaji's. And so my point is, if you take a look at all the evidence that was in the record, the evidence that Mr. Bhatia testified to, he said, hey, look, she stayed at the Burnsville residence whenever she wanted to. She stayed at Maharaji's whenever she wanted to. She was there. I was there. I stayed at Maharaji's. I stayed at Burnsville. She stayed at Burnsville with me four or five times a month. And I stayed at Maharaji's.
So, Mr. Rogoshevsky, you are asking us to reverse the summary judgment motion because there are fact issues that you think a jury should decide. Is that the bottom line?
That's the bottom line, Your Honor.
It sounds like you're giving us a closing argument.
Well, I just think that if you take a look at the evidence, these people were so close with one another. The brother, the sister, and Mr. Bhatia in the business, that they interacted together. And anyway, and as you saw in the record, Mr. Bhatia pulled himself up from the bootstraps, and he had the accountants take care of dealing with all the money that went to the kids. And he had an insurance agent from day one for 25 years. He said, you got to take care of my kids. And so that's that third factor in the Prima and Fireman's case. The duration was substantial here. Now, what Mr. Johnson is saying is, well, she was going to move out. Well, first of all, the record is clear that she never got the key to the place. So she never stayed day one in that apartment. She might have paid for it. But you understand under insurance contracts, I've got at least 10 days or 15 days under most policies where I can call up the insurance company and say, hey, look, I changed my residence, but I still want my kid covered. And so it's a red herring about her, whether she moved out. For 3.5 years, they were in this intimate family relationship. And I think that
was it appropriate for the district court to consider her future intent as to residence?
Well, I think that third factor is it says where the intended duration is likely to be substantial, whether it is consistent with the informality of the relationship, which it is, and reasonable to conclude that the parties would consider relationship in contracting about insurance. I think that could have happened. And number two,
so it sounds like that your answer to my question is yes, that was okay for the district court to consider her future intent.
I think it was a red herring because you can change your insurance within 15 or 20 days when you move. You're still covered under any kind of contract, and you would be covered under this contract. So it was inappropriate for her to say, and I don't even think the judge factored that in her decision. She mainly honed in. And she wasn't under the same roof. She felt that she had to be under the same roof. And it just doesn't happen in divorces. I mean, it can't happen in divorces. And it can't happen in this type
of situation. Well, this was a little bit different than a case involving a divorce because the case also involved an adult child.
Well,
would you agree with that?
But I guess, you know, you're still covered under your health insurance until you're 26, if you're still going to school and things of that nature and involved, and with your family. I just think that in this type of situation, you're discriminating against divorced people and people that have business relationships intertwined in their whole family relationship. And here, Mr. Bhatia said to his 35-year insurance agent, my kids have got to be covered. They're in the business. Cover them. Cover me on everything. Accountants, take care of my kids. I'm going to give them whatever they want. And it's all going to come through me. It's all written out on Maharajis. And I stay at Maharajis. My son stays at Maharajis. We stay at the Burnsville. Each kid has a room in his Burnsville address at the time of this accident. And you have to look at the time of the accident and the relationship leading up to this accident. And I think it's clear that what the district court did is she focused on you have to live under one roof. And it's impossible in this family situation. And it's impossible in most divorces. A lot of divorces, you have a cabin. The kids go up to the cabin. Or the kids stay in a business like this. I think it's common. And I think that's where the court failed here. And as you can see in the final paragraph of the court's order, she's saying she didn't live under the same roof as Mr. Bhatia. But the evidence, the affidavit is clear. She stayed four or five times at the Burnsville residence with Mr. Bhatia. She had a key. She could come and go as she pleased at the Burnsville residence. She could come and go as she pleased at the Maharaji residence, which was the business and the apartments upstairs where everybody stayed. I call your attention.
Mr. Rogoshevsky?
101.
Mr. Rogoshevsky, Judge Ross is trying to ask you a question.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm not sure if you're able to hear me or not. Am I coming through?
I can hear you now. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. How would you succinctly respond to the district court's summation? And I'll just read to you from page 7. There is no indication that she intended to reside at the plaintiff's Burnsville home again in the future. She occasionally spent the night at the Burnsville home a few times per month. This is insufficient to establish residency or that the Burnsville home was her usual residence. What's your summation as to why that is erroneous?
Well, the case law, and specifically this Victoria decision, focused on whether or not the child was self-supporting. In all these cases cited by counsel for the respondent, the children, and I still consider a 21-year-old child, but in any event, they're all self-supporting. Here, Ina Bhatia is not self-supporting. Ina Bhatia depended on her father for everything. And she was residing primarily with her father at the insurance company address, where the insurance company thought Mr. Bhatia was residing.
What you're saying is that there are facts that contradict the district court statement.
I am, Your Honor, and it should be a factual determination by a jury. She just took the facts and ignored the other facts that were in this intimate family relationship. And I think the case law says if you're in that intimate family relationship, that's what normal people would assume would be covered by your insurance contract. Not some little technicality in a divorce situation or in a business situation where the cultural issues arise like this. And then so the court erred. And there's clearly a lot of facts here that indicate that she was living under his roof. His roof had to be two residents. A lot of people have two residents. They live in Florida and they live in Minnesota. And I think that the court overlooked that. The court overlooked the fact that the apartments are really family homes. Nobody else resides in them. No, there's nobody paying rent up above there. There's not a bill that Ina had to pay for electricity or gas or any kind of anything. It was all provided for by her father and the business of Maharaji's, which was part of the father's residence, just like his home in Burnsville was. And just like if she stayed with her mother in a divorce situation, why would you punish people that are divorced and have that kind of an intimate family relationship? At least there's a factual basis there for people to conclude that it was an intimate family relationship. You saw how passionate the father was in his deposition about saying how it was his duty to take care of his daughter. And he would take care of her forever. And he took care of all her wants and needs. And in that type of a situation, that's a factual basis. And the court erred here in just discarding those facts and not considering them. I thank you.
Thank you for your argument.
I can end 30 seconds earlier.
Thank you. And if you wouldn't mind muting yourself, Mr. Rogoszewski, we will now turn to Mr. Johnson, who will be arguing for respondent. Mr. Johnson, you may proceed.
Good morning. Stuart Johnson on behalf of the respondent. May it please the court, counsel. Ina Batia was not a resident relative under the policy issued by respondent owner's insurance to Jit Batia, who is the sole named insured. Therefore, we request the court affirm the district court's decision. In order to determine coverage, the initial burden is on the party claiming coverage, or in this case, the appellant. Appellant cites the liability or the portion of the policy, not the UM endorsement at issue in this case. It's important from the onset to frame what's going on or what the facts of this accident are. It does not involve any of the vehicles described on the policy. There's some argument and some things in the papers about vehicles being insured. A respondent doesn't dispute that. And in fact, there's two levels or ways to get coverage for uninsured motorist coverage. The first being if it involves any of the vehicles described on the policy. There's some talk about being a rated driver. Yes, but that's a red herring or irrelevant in this purposes because the accident didn't involve any rated vehicles or any described vehicles. No different than being a rated driver on a business policy, for example, that doesn't get you insured status. In order for someone to have coverage or be entitled to benefits when they're not described as a named insured, which Ina obviously wasn't, and it's not a vehicle described in the declarations, which it wasn't, it has to be a relative. And the policy provides some unambiguous language for a relative. It's a person related by blood or marriage. There's no dispute that a father and daughter fit that part. But the second and the part that is at issue is they have to reside together. And here they simply did not. We'll look at the facts as presented by the appellant and throughout the record of the written interrogatories, the deposition, and then an errata sheet after the fact. Ina, as the court had pointed out, was of majority. She'd lived alone for multiple years and was not attending school. There's this talk about a divorce situation. It's important to note that this is not a situation where a child is living between divorced parents. In fact, this person is living on their own at a separate address, distinct from either parent, a third address, if you will. It's not shuffling back and forth as argued. In the answers to interrogatories, the deposition, and the errata page, Jit Batia states that he lived in a single-family home in Burnsville. There was a room available, and she visited from time to time, but St. Paul was her apartment, and that's where she went back to. The mail, the driver's license, the death certificate all state the addresses in St. Paul or the residences in St. Paul. In the interrogatories, this is the chosen language by the appellant, where she lived. She was, quote, residing at 205 West 7th in St. Paul, the Maharaja's business apartment. That's the residence that the appellant said that Ina Batia was living at. Likewise, in her deposition, living in the St. Paul building, did not live with anyone except her boyfriend occasionally. Miles, her boyfriend, lived there, nobody else. And it goes on in the deposition that she's in the process of moving to another apartment. She had packed her things and was in the process of moving someplace separate and distinct from the residence of her father or the residence of her mother. The court asked a question about if intent matters or if intended duration matters. And I submit to you, it does matter. The list of the cited cases in our materials, a lot of the analysis the court provide is the intent of the parties or the intended duration. And that is a big determining factor in the outcome of those various cases, whether there was intent to have a short-term stay or whether there was an intent that that place be their residence. And the undisputed material facts in this case show that the intent was that the Burnsville house was not a residence or an intended residence. It was either this St. Paul apartment or this forthcoming or different apartment that she was in the process of moving to.
What about the fact that the policy address was the same building as the apartment? Does that, in your view, create a closer question as to whether there's an issue of material fact regarding, you know, where she was residing?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor, because you can set up a mailing address or send mail wherever you'd like. You can send mail to a post office box, for example, or a business address. Here, the fact is that her apartment was in St. Paul. His residence, or where the sole named insured lived, was in Burnsville, and that's the issue. Going on to the testimony or the factual record, at the end of his deposition, Mr. Bhatia says, Burnsville was my house. St. Paul was her apartment. And then the errata sheet after the fact attempting to correct some testimony or change some testimony stated, after she graduated, she stayed in the apartment. When killed, she was living in St. Paul. The death certificate also lists the residence of St. Paul. And there was...
But that errata sheet also says that sometimes she stayed in Burnsville. And I don't think the district court addressed that fact in its order. And so I'm wondering if you could explain how, in your view, that doesn't create a genuine issue of material fact.
Sure. The court did talk in its order about the district court about visiting or being at the Burnsville house from time to time or having a key, but it really goes to the intent or the actions of the parties. One can stay or have an overnight. It's the expected duration or what the intent is. And that's what the case law says, as well as, are you staying there for a mere visitation period or an overnight, or are you intending that to be your residence? And I do think that the district court addressed that. And I think the materials provided address that as well, the intentionality of it. There are some of the cases that are cited, a three week or a month duration in between places is not enough to establish residency. This off and on for a few times a month, even if true, it's not enough to establish residency.
Mr. Johnson, the Skarsten case talks about how it's a fact question about whether or not they are residing together. Do you think the judge erred when she ruled on the facts or weighed the facts?
I don't believe she did, Your Honor, and partially because the undisputed evidence that she's weighing is that they didn't. The sworn deposition testimony, the sworn affidavits, the sworn errata sheet is all differentiating between the two. He lived here, she lived in St. Paul at this apartment. The court can address undisputed material facts in reaching a legal conclusion or evaluating a policy, which they did. And
I just want to stop you there. So your argument is essentially that no reasonable juror could find that they resided together.
I think the totality of the evidence in the record establishes that they did not reside together based on the unambiguous language of the policy and based on the statements of of essentially Mr. Bhatia, who's at issue in this case.
Just to be clear, I'm not sure. I was curious about your answer to Judge Gaitis's question. I mean, she asked whether there was any disputed fact over the question, and you said under the totality of the circumstances, she didn't reside there. Those are different. That's not answering the same question. So are you saying there's no evidence from which a jury could reach a contrary conclusion? It's different from under the totality of the circumstances. This is the conclusion.
I don't believe there is with the information that's been presented or the information in the record. I reside in Burnsville. She resides in St. Paul at the business apartment, and that's the language that's used. The Victoria Court, we talked about the one factor, or Mr. Rogaszewski did. The others that the court did determine, and it's a totality situation. One is the first factor is living under the same roof, and I think it's undisputed that they did not. In a close, intimate relationship, we didn't contest it at the district court and don't contest that here. And the intended duration is likely to be substantial. And that's where the intent gets in, and that's where of the relationship or of the living arrangements. And here, that's central to what's going on. The intent before was this separate address, and the intent at the time of her death was also a separate address, separate and distinct from where she was living.
What about the fact that she's going from an apartment where she doesn't pay rent under, you know, dad's roof, a building owned by dad, to an apartment where she's presumably going to be paying rent? Would that allow a reasonable juror to conclude otherwise?
I don't think that the payment of the rent is central to this, or is really a factor. I think the evidence is his dad was still going to be paying rent, just at a separate location. And that doesn't really, what cuts the heart is where the residence was, and if the residence was separate than the named insured. And then this case, the facts indicate that it wasn't. The cases kind of turn on this intention of one family unit or not. And a lot of that is the intended stay together under the same roof. And the district court does focus on that. The court talked briefly with Mr. Rogaszewski, or mentioned the divorce situation. And the cases cited fail. And one of the reasons it was hit on is this American Family Way Thyme case. It's a 10-year-old child living between two divorced parents. And as the court indicated, this is a person of majority, and it's not splitting time between the home of a mother, a father, or between one parent and another. This is a separate and distinct residence.
Mr. Jensen, most of the cases you're relying on are cases that were appealed after a jury verdict, challenging the sufficiency of the evidence underlying that verdict. How are we to view those cases at this procedural stage where the district court granted summary judgment and no trial occurred?
Sure. Yeah. I think it goes to what the cases stand for, or what is not residency or under this resident relative exclusion. Some of the cases they cut both ways. There are ones that are liability portions of the policy. And if they're a resident relative, there is not coverage, or if they're a resident relative, there is coverage. And it's really dependent on they're focusing on the residence. And that's what's at issue for us today. And so it's determining, based on the undisputed facts, which the court determined, that there was or was not residence. And those cases are guidance as to what is enough of an intent or a duration for residence, and what is not enough of an intent or duration for residence. And so that's the lens I believe that the court should look at those as far as what is enough ties or what is enough contacts to be considered a resident under one address or not. And so I think they are very authoritative for that purpose. And I really think that the guidepost here is just the intentionality or the intent. There wasn't a plan for Ms. Bhatia to move back and live under the same family unit with her father. That's in the undisputed evidence. She hadn't lived there in some time other than some various visits or overnight, and in fact had continued to make overt actions or take overt steps to not return to that same home in Burnsville in the future. It was not her intent, like the college cases that we see where there's not a permanent residence that's been established. She'd established a permanent residence. That was either St. Paul, in the business apartments above the business, which each apartment is a distinct legal address, or it's this unknown or unknown address of this other apartment that she's taking steps to live in at the time of her death, including paying for rent and moving some items apparently over there. There was overt steps taken to showing that that was going to be her new residence. The totality of evidence is that the policyholder Jit Bhatia resided in Burnsville, separate and apart for his daughter, who either resided in St. Paul, a separate residence, not with the named insured, or in a new apartment. And as such, we respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's order in its entirety. And I thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Rogoszewski, you have the opportunity to provide rebuttal. Would you like to use that? And you're muted.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be brief. I just want to call the court's attention to the Scarsden versus Darrellin case that I cited in my brief. There, that was a 24-year-old daughter who lived in Minneapolis. Her father lived in Benson. She retained a room at her father's residence. The same fact situation as here. There was no question about it. There was a room at the Burnsville address. She was living in Minneapolis, where she kept some clothes there, and she spent one or two weekends a month at the family home. This is four or five times a month in the fact situation here. There, the district court said she didn't reside in the same household. Again, the Court of Appeals reversed, focusing on the intimate, informal family relationship that comes about because of divorces. Counsel keeps citing the record that it was clear that he was at the Burnsville address and she was at the St. Paul address. Page 101, question by Mr. Johnson. From your testimony, I understand she's not living at the Heritage Circle in Burnsville any longer. When was the last time she kind of lived with you or you lived together? Answer, she lived at Heritage Circle. If I was there, she was with me at the time. Upstairs, she had an apartment. I had an apartment across. So we were all living there. My son was living there. I was living there in this apartment building. The whole floor was ours. She was always with us, you know. If you were in town, we were always together. And that was on West 7th. Yes. How many apartments are there? Four. She had one. You had one. My son had one. How about the fourth one? We just kept it empty if we needed it. There's evidence in the record that this is a divorce situation. There's two residents and they're living there. The other evidence in the record is on page 72. She hadn't paid rent or something like that. That's the question about the new apartment. That's what they said. She hadn't, but she had paid the rent to the management company. I see. So they would not let her in because she needed keys. So the person that was there. So at the time of the death, she didn't even have a key to the apartment. She hadn't even slept there. That was the answer. So all that evidence is in the record. And what we're talking about here is this child from age 18 was intimately involved in this business. She stayed at the Burnsville address. She stayed at the business address. And and there's no question in the record. The insurance company sent all the bills to Jit Bhatia at Maharaji's 205 West 7th Street. And so the insurance company thinks that Jit lives at 205 West 7th Street. There's nothing that indicates that he's at the Burnsville residence in any correspondence by that insurance company. So here, what I'm saying, like the Scarsden case says, it says, look, you've got to look at this intimate family relationship. And certainly these are all facts in the record before the errata sheet that are in the record that the court considered. And I just call your attention to his affidavit for my final statements here. And you read from paragraph 5 to 8, ever since the children could work, they had worked for a business at Maharaji's as well as the other businesses I had. When I was divorced, and they got divorced when she was 8, my wife and I jointly shared the children. Up until the divorce, we lived in Burnsville. After the divorce, I always had a room for each child at my residence in Burnsville. Also, I had apartments above Maharaji's store, 205 East 7th Street. There was always one apartment for the family. There was an apartment in the basement that was for anyone in the family. Family members periodically stayed in the apartment. Both Ina and Inder and myself at various times stayed in the apartments above Maharaj's for a number of years, including specifically the year 2016. That's when Ina died. I now currently live above Maharaj's. Maharaj's address consists of 201 to 207 East 7th Street. The U.S. Postal Service delivers any mail for these addresses to Maharaj's main entrance central location at 205 East 7th Street. There's factual basis in the record for a jury to find that she's a resident relative. And I asked the court to overturn the district court here and remand this case back. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. At this point, we will take a recess.